Perf Talk is brought to you in part by GCRockboard.com, home of quality handcrafted pedal boards and your number one source for some of the best pedal brands in the market. Okay, welcome everybody to Perf Talk, and today we have YouTube's most favorite Filipino guitar guy.
Who, you?
RJ Ronquillo. No, you. RJ Ronquillo.
Hello, kumusta?
Hey, RJ, how's it going?
Going good. Good to see you, Perf. I got my new shirt in the mail just now.
Nice. Yeah, so how did you get started?
So my dad had instruments throughout the house, and he played a little bit of piano, guitar, saxophone, sang, you know, typical Filipino people, played a bunch of instruments. And it probably wasn't until, you know, the mid 80s, we had MTV, everything was on, you know, TV, you're seeing live music and everything. So that was pretty much like a big influence. And then, like most people, you know, in my age group, Back to the Future, when that came out, you know, cool kids playing guitar on the big screen, you're like, wow, I want to do that. So it's a very common story that I've heard from many of my friends too. Like, Back to the Future was kind of the instigator for, you know, getting into guitar. And that was probably, I mean, I was probably around 8 or 9 years old. So I kind of noodled around on some, you know, student acoustic that my dad had, and figured stuff out on my own. And then I asked him if I could take guitar lessons at the local music store, which I signed up for, and I went through the Mel Bay Blue Book, which teaches you the most basic stuff, you know, Mary Had a Little Lamb and all that stuff. And then gradually started learning, you know, blues and rock stuff. And I kind of stopped taking guitar lessons and started learning stuff on my own for a little bit. You know, I was picking up all the Guitar Player magazines, all the Guitar for the Practicing Musician magazines, and learning the tabs that were in those mags and everything. And then eventually I kind of wanted to learn more different styles of music. So I took jazz guitar lessons when I was like 13. So because, you know, I wanted to be, you know, a little more educated as far as music and music theory and learn more stuff. You know, at that time I was into probably like shred stuff, Steve Vai and all these other kind of, you know, classic rock.
The 80s.
Yeah, it's the 80s.
Yeah.
So, I don't know, I kind of wanted to be a virtuoso guitarist. I thought, if I learn jazz, then I'll be a better guitar player. So I decided to learn, you know, jazz, and I played a little bit of everything in high school. Went to college. Do you want to stop me?
No. During high school, did you have jazz band in high school?
Yeah, we did have a jazz band, and I kind of did it half-assed. Like, I signed up. I went to a couple rehearsals, and I did a couple performances, but I thought it was kind of nerdy. So, and I wanted to do my own thing. I wanted to have my own band and play, like weird rock and fusion stuff, so...
You didn't go to band camp?
Well, actually, I did. So, yeah, right before high school, me and my friend, who I was playing in a band with, we went to a music camp in Michigan called Blue Lake or something, if it was called. And we did, like, the jazz band there. So, I did go to band camp.
Okay. So, any one-time at band camp stories?
Well, okay, I have a really cool band camp story. This is for guitar players, but I think towards the end of camp, I can't remember how long it was, maybe like 2 weeks long or something. I had met another camper. I can't remember what instrument he played or whatever, but it happened to be, I think his name was John, but it was John Daddario, who was the son at the time. So we're probably the same age. And I think John is now like the head honcho at Daddario now. But I think I met him at this camp because I remember he told me, yeah, Because I was like the only guitar player at this camp. So he saw me. I was like, yeah, my dad is John Daddario Sr. or whatever his name was. He gave me a Daddario t-shirt and a free pack of strings. So it was like my first kind of introduction to what NAMM would be like when I was 13.
That's cool. And so all throughout high school, and that influenced your choice of college?
It sort of did. So I was kind of confused about going to college right when I graduated high school. So my first year of college, I just wanted to go to a regular liberal arts school just to get my feet wet with the whole living away from home and going to college type of thing. So I didn't study music the first year of college. I went to like a small school in northern Florida. And then I was so bored and I really wanted to get back to playing music and learning music. So I decided to apply to the University of Miami, which was down in southern Florida. So I auditioned and went in as a music engineering major, which my idea when I entered the program was like, oh, I'm going to work in a recording studio and learn how to use, you know, mixing board and all that stuff. No, it was like really heavy math and science and like audio engineering and acoustic design and all this crap that I didn't want to learn, you know? And I mean, like the people that went through that program are hugely successful. You know, some of them work for like Dolby or like Sony and all the, you know, making microphones and designing things like that. But I wanted to just like work in the studio. Little did I know at the time, like I just wanted to play in the studio. I wanted to be a performer. So pretty much halfway through that first year of music engineering, I decided I wanted to transfer majors to the jazz program and just be a performing major. So I did that. And the next year I came back as I think the program was technically called Studio Music and Jazz, but it was pretty much jazz guitar.
University of Miami, that's where Steve Morse went to, right?
Yeah, a lot of cool cats went there. Steve Morse, Jaco Pastorius, Andy Timmons went there for a little bit, Pat Metheny, Will Lee. I think his dad was actually the head of the jazz department for a time in the early days. Some other great players too, but I was more excited that Andy Timmons had gone there for a little bit. Like, whoa, Andy Timmons, he's awesome.
By that time, you've heard of Andy Timmons already?
Yes. That's another story. I have so many good stories. So in the States, in the, I would say, kind of mid-80s to the 90s, there was I guess it was a summer camp as well, but it was called National Guitar Summer Workshop. Yeah. So yeah, it was in Connecticut. So the first year, I went there twice. The first year I went there, I was in a jazz class, but one of the guest artists at the time, this was probably 1990, maybe 91, was Andy Timmons. And he came in, and I knew Andy Timmons, though. He's the guy from Danger Danger, hair metal guy. Yeah. But he came into my jazz class and started jamming like jazz licks, and I was like, what, how does this guy know jazz, you know? And then, you know, later that evening or the next evening, he performed and he was playing like all this really cool fusiony blues, you know, jazz metal stuff. I'm like, he became like my favorite guitar player, and to this day I used to have a cassette of that performance that I listened to over and over again. I can't find it anymore, but I wish I had it, because it was a bootleg of early Andy Timmons and it was so good. So he was like really influential to kind of the way I play now, subconsciously.
Okay. Nice. Because back in the Philippines, I've only heard of Andy Timmons for that Danger Danger record. Mm-hmm. And then there's a short clip there where he started playing jazz lines, and then he got yelled at, "Hey, Andy, rock out," or something. Some cheesy thing like that. Yeah, and then he went for a clinic. He was away from the hair metal look already.
Yeah, yeah.
And my friend brought his Danger Danger CD. So that was fun. But yeah, okay.
What was the atmosphere like in University of Miami? Like, was it like a guitar centric school? Since a lot of years.
Well, went there? So when I went there, this would have been the mid 90s. I only graduated with like three other guitar players in my class. So it wasn't like, you know, there was a lot of jazz musicians as a whole. So we had, you know, guitar players, bass players, piano players, horn players, drummers, everything. So, and we all hung out together. It wasn't like only the guitar players hung out. And it was definitely not something like, I guess, Berkeley, where there's hundreds of guitar players, or GIT that has, you know, tons of guitar players. So it's not, right. It wasn't anything like that. It was more like a big college. And then the School of Music was a section of this college. And yeah, I mean, I think I literally graduated with two other guitar players.
From what I remember of when I read that Steve Morse interview and he was talking about University of Miami, was that he wanted to go to school for music. But when he auditioned, since he couldn't play classical, they lumped him into the jazz, the jazz department, you know. So it's like, so I was just wondering what the atmosphere was like.
Yeah, well, so the first year, actually, when I was a music engineering major, we had to take a bunch of performance classes, and I had to take classical guitar lessons for that first year because that was just part of the curriculum. Right. I was a music engineering major, but since it was still in the music school, I was a jazz guitar music engineering major or whatever. So I had to take private lessons in jazz guitar. And that's probably one of the reasons that I wanted to switch over, because I enjoyed those classes more than I enjoyed my, you know, calculus and acoustic design classes. I just wanted to play guitar and do that stuff. So yeah, it was a cool program because it was hard, actually, but you had all these different classes that you were taking. But because I had to basically take double the amount of classes as a normal, you know, jazz guitar major would, it was so difficult. I couldn't juggle, you know, my guitar lessons with my science classes and everything. It was just like, ugh, this sucks. I just want to do one thing.
They focused more on the engineering aspect rather than the music aspect.
Exactly.
Okay, now, you were born here in the U.S., right?
Yes.
Have you ever visited back in the Philippines?
I have once, in 1996.
Okay.
Were you there?
Yeah, I was still there. That was the height of the band scene.
Yeah.
There, so everybody... I left River Maya by then. But I was doing other stuff. I was playing with my blues rock trio, and I was running my recording studio and producing stuff.
Okay.
Right around that time. Where did you visit?
So I remember we stayed for the most part in Makati. We would visit my family members all over the province or whatever. So we drove to the countryside. My dad is from Cavite, Nai Cavite. I remember going there and hanging out and having a fiesta or whatever. And then my mom's side, I can't remember where her brother-in-law was living, but it was out of the city. So, and we went during Christmas. So we spent Christmas and New Year's in the Philippines.
That was pretty hectic.
Yeah. I remember going to the mall in Makati, and it was crazy.
Yeah. And then if you stayed there until New Year, then you've experienced like Philippines New Year with the fireworks and all that.
And the gunshots, yeah. Yeah. They sound the same.
And then were you able to check out music during that time? Probably difficult.
You know what? I vaguely remember going to the hotel bar lounge. I remember being impressed by the band because they were like, "Wow, these guys sound great," you know. And at this time, I was already in music school, so I was kind of a snob. I was kind of a music snob, but I remember being like, "Yeah, they can play." And the funny thing is, later on in my career, when I was a professional musician, multiple people would come up to me and be like, "Oh, you're Filipino? Man, all the Filipino musicians I know are like super, super good and talented, and they know how to copy exactly like this particular singer or this particular musician." That kind of clicked because I remember, you know, seeing that band, that cover band, and they were better than any cover band I had ever seen in the States. And then we get fast forward to Journey and the whole thing. It's I kind of want to work on a documentary about if there's something in the DNA of Filipino people that make them, you know, have this weird talent for music. And like the talent that I mean is like being able to copy, you know, the voice of whoever, or sing real good, or have, you know, it's like an innate inborn rhythm or something.
Well, Filipinos are really musical. Like every family in the Philippines has a guitar player. That's not an exaggeration. Like every Filipino parties before the magic sing the magic sing mic and the karaoke machines, there was an uncle who'd play guitar. And towards the end, towards the middle part of the party, when things start happening, somebody would bust out the guitar and everybody would take turns singing. So that's
that was my dad.
Yeah, there you go, there you go. So in this case, it wasn't an uncle; it was your dad. Even in the provinces, they'd hold, like, you know, during fiestas, there'd be singing competitions and all that. And they didn't have backing tracks. It was one guy playing guitar. And what he would do is the contestants would line up, right? And, of course, he wouldn't know every song. So he'd have the contestants sing the first couple of lines, and he'd find it, you know, and... okay, let's go. So they start performing, and the first pass of the verse would be like, you know, him trying to find the chords. But the second pass, the amazing thing that happens is because it's no longer like basic chords, he suddenly starts adding things, you know, embellishments and all that. And it towards the end of it becomes this whole guitar and voice arrangement, you know. And a lot of it is very crude as well, because most of those guitar players are lefties, but they play the guitar without changing the strings around. So all the chords are backwards. You'll see the backwards chords, and then the pinky would be doing all the lead lines.
Whoa!
all the embellishments. It's amazing. It boggles the mind, and I could never figure it out.
Yeah.
But that's one of the innate talents of Filipinos.
Yeah, it's having an ear.
Yeah.
Because my dad, I think, pretty much played by ear.
Yeah.
He didn't know anything about music theory or music.
And it's the creativity as well. It's like they hear something on a record or on the radio, and I don't know, there's something innate where, I guess, but just chasing the tone or chasing the notes, that they come up with stuff to make it sound like just like how they hear it.
Yeah. You
know? Yeah, it's weird.
They're good copycats. But I mean, also they have their own style as well, but they can copy anything.
Yeah. And right around that time, 80s to 90s, pretty much every cover band within the Southeast Asian region are Filipino bands.
Yeah.
That's their gig. That's their way out of poverty, actually. Sure. Yeah, so the goal there was to get in a band and go abroad. That's pretty much what Arnel did.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I noticed also I've been on some cruises, and a lot of the band members on cruise ships, well, I mean, a lot of the employees on cruise ships are Filipino, but a lot of the talent on those ships are Filipino as well.
Growing up, were you exposed to, like, the Filipino music?
No. I when I think back at it, I couldn't name you one Filipino song. I mean, Dahil Sa'yo, I didn't know about until like 10 years ago. You know?
Okay.
But yeah, my parents never really sang traditional Filipino songs that I remember. And some of the, you know, my parents always had records, and there might have been like one or two Filipino records that I can't even remember who it was. But for most part, it was like English music.
As far as culture goes, Philippines is a mixed match of everything.
Yeah.
Yeah, Asian, Spanish, American.
The only connection I have to Filipino music is my name. When my parents had told me that I was named after RJ and the Riots, Ramon Jacinto, I guess, used to go to like whatever parties and RJ and the Riots would play. So that's, they never knew him, but they knew of him or whatever. So they actually had, I guess they decided to call me RJ and then figured out what they would, the R and the J would stand for later. But yeah, that's the story they tell me, that I was named after Ramon Jacinto. And funny enough, a couple NAMs ago, I got to meet him and like jam with him and talk about, you know, my story and everything.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we got to connect, and I showed my dad the picture of me and Ramon Jacinto. It was cool.
Nice. Yeah, I was kind of wondering about that, because like RJ, the way it's spelled or written, that's pretty much his signature.
Yeah, and funny enough, when I went to the Philippines, I freaked out when I saw everything RJ, RJ Cafe, RJ Music Store, RJ Guitars. I was like, oh my God, what's going on? Is it all for me? But then like I'm like, oh my God, that's a Ramon Jacinto stuff. And I learned about how he became this Dick Clark of the Philippines and owns like, runs, you know, the radio stations and all these clubs and music stores and everything. And I think that's so cool.
He built everything. He's got a big conglomerate.
Yeah.
That's still going on until this day. So earlier you mentioned, you know, getting into all these styles of music. Was there like a plan to be a versatile musician at the time, or it was just, or was it just, oh hey, I like this, oh I like this too, or
that pretty much. I didn't really have a plan. Like I kind of had a loose plan when I was in college that I wanted to be a session musician, like a recording guy. But for the most part, early on in you know, when I was younger and in high school and learning different styles of music, it was more like, oh, I like reggae. I want to learn reggae guitar, or, you know, Wes Montgomery sounds cool. I want to learn some of those licks. So it was more like learning all these different styles stems from me genuinely liking the music that I was listening to and wanting to learn that thing. It wasn't really, oh, in order to be a successful working musician, I have to learn all these different styles so I can be a chameleon in the studio and be able to cover everything. It helps, obviously, but for the most part, I enjoy all those different styles.
Did you tackle them all at once, or did you go through phases? Like, oh, I'm in my reggae phase, I'm in my jazz phase.
Yeah, I mean, I went through phases partly out of necessity. Like, I got into reggae a lot because I was actually touring with a reggae band, Inner Circle. And they, you know, I went into I actually did like an audition, but I pretty much had that gig anyways. So I went in, played, and what I thought was reggae guitar was close, but they taught me the exact way, and it was more of a feel thing. So the more and more I would hang out with them, you know, I toured with them for many years. So I was on the bus, you know, and backstage with them and hanging out, and they were playing music and all this stuff. And I was learning about reggae and reggae history. And so I was around it so much that, you know, I was listening to it all the time. And, all, you know, I still love it to this day. I mean, I listen to it every day even when I'm working out or whatever. So that's something that, you know, I had listened to reggae prior to that gig, but I didn't get into it as much as I did when I started playing, you know, professionally, that music. And same thing with like R&B. You know, I listened to some R&B music, but I didn't get really into it until I started playing it in cover bands and weddings and clubs and stuff, and learning more about it. See, that, and that's part of my personality. If I'm kind of immersed in something, whether it's music or a music style or like a hobby, I obsess over it, and what my wife calls nerding out. So I'll go on YouTube and just watch a bunch of videos about, you know, whatever, motorcycles or skateboarding or something, for like months. Like, And that's part of my personality. I don't know if it's obsessive or I just like get really into what I'm doing or focused on.
You know, that's a common trait about with people who get really good at what they do. Like personally, when I was starting out, I didn't stop at CC DeVille. I didn't stop at Slash. I started learning about their background and who they listened to, like, you know, or Steve Vine, or I didn't stop at Steve Ray Vaughan. I had to dig in and check out Albert King and all the Kings and Buddy Guy and all that. And same thing when I started mountain biking. You nerd out and you get obsessed and for a while it takes over, you know.
It's funny because we're the same thing, but yeah, like eventually sometimes it'll just fade away or like you'll put it on the back burner. Like maybe a couple of years ago I was really into motorcycles and working on my bike and riding and everything, and this year I haven't ridden my bike once. It's there. I still know how it feels and I enjoy it, but I'm not concerned about it right now. So I do go through phases.
Yeah. Okay, how did you get your start doing sessions? For that Inner Circle gig, I mean, you weren't really a reggae musician, but you got into that gig anyway.
Yeah, I got that gig. I was playing another gig, and our keyboard player was friends with the drummer from Inner Circle, and the drummer from Inner Circle came to our gig, checked it out. At the time, they were in need of a touring guitar player. And he liked what I did. He liked how I played and invited me out to their studio to hang out and rehearse or audition or whatever. So that's basically that's kind of how it all started, even with the recording sessions, because he was kind of like my entryway into a lot of the recording sessions that I did, because Inner Circle owns a really nice recording studio kind of complex. They call it Circle House, but it's in North Miami. So while I was touring with them, they would ask me to come and hang out at the studio of the house and kind of be an on-call guitar player for various producers and stuff. So they kind of got my foot in the door for me for like that session I did for the Tupac Shakur stuff, a lot of the R&B stuff I did at their studio.
So nice. Okay, what would be your top five tips for players wanting to break into that or to get into that?
My number one tip is meet as many people as possible. Obviously right now you can't go out and meet people, but you know, try to just be friendly with people. Because you never, I say this all the time, you never know who's going to call you for a gig or for a session or something. So it's very important to network and be friendly with people and get on their good side and everything. Because I think, at least for me, in my experience, that's how I got, when I think about how I got gigs and work and stuff, that's, you know, it was a phone call from somebody or my number got passed around, because people knew me or, you know, they respected me or they could vouch for me or whatever. So it's number one is meet as many people as you can, network. Mm-hmm. And then kind of like with any work I do, it's just kind of, don't be a dick. It's like,
yeah, that's important.
I mean, you could be the most talented guitarist in the world, but if you don't have a great personality or you're not good fun to work with, mm-hmm. then you're not going to get the gig or you're not going to keep the gig. So just, you know, be personable, be a good person, and that'll show through. And people, you know, you could be, you know, not the greatest musician or an okay musician, but you have a great personality and you're going to get called, you're going to get hired because people want to hang out with you and work with you. So that's really just the two main tips that I always have for people that want to get into the business.
Is location a factor?
It was. But it also depends on what kind of work you want to get into. if you want to get into studio, high profile studio work, for the most part, LA and Nashville are where you want to be. But that's a whole nother can of worms, because you have to get into those circles first, which could take a lifetime. If you want to be a touring guy, kind of the same thing, LA, Nashville, New York, Miami. You know, I did get some decent tours when I lived in Miami, but it was limited. The genres are limited because the market coming out of Miami is Latin music, world music, reggae, and hip-hop, R&B sometimes. I don't know if it is now. And then this is at least, as far as I know, when I was, you know, working in those markets. But I mean, nowadays, because we have social media and internet and YouTube and everything, you can get discovered and you can work remotely. Like if you want to do session work, it's definitely possible for you to get work remotely and do just e-sessions and email files back and forth. But I know at least here in Nashville, it rarely works out like that, because it's such a business that's been around for a long time. Like the recording business here in Nashville has been around for forever. And so they're dialed in, like going to the studio and having session times blocked. It's like a normal job here. So, but in LA, it's different.
Yeah, well, I guess like for some producers, they're after the studio sound as well, right? For their setup.
Yes. You know, being able to play with other musicians at the same time to get that take is a big thing too.
Yeah. And unless you have a setup like Tim Pierce.
Yeah.
Well, it's hard to get that trust.
Yeah. Tim is like, he's been there, done that. He's trustworthy. People know what they're going to get when they hire Tim to do sessions. So he doesn't have to go to a studio necessarily, you know.
Yeah, just sit in his control, his mothership.
Yeah. I mean, ideally, that's kind of how I would want to do it. I just did a session at a friend's studio a couple weeks ago, and I had to kind of tear down all my gear to bring it over there. And I was like, you know, it would have been a lot easier if you just send me the files, and because all my amps are already hooked up and ready to go, and all my guitars are here. So I would have had more access to different sounds had I just worked in my home studio, as opposed to only being able to bring like four or five guitars and a couple pedals and two amps or whatever.
And when you moved around, did that influence the type of session work that you got as well? Or did you move because of the session work that you got? Or did you got hired for?
It was kind of, I moved because I was seeking certain types of work. So, you know, I kind of started my professional career in Miami. And I had just toured with Ricky Martin. This was like 2007. And I was like, this is probably the highest level of touring that I'm going to get out of Miami. And I want to get something more. I want more. I want something bigger. I want like a big pop tour. So I had, you know, the great idea of moving to LA, because I wanted to do whatever pop tour, rock tour, basically like, you know, English market stuff, because it was different than what I was doing in Miami. And that's, and you know, that was more my thing, is like, you know, I started playing guitar because I wanted to be in a rock band or touring, whatever. I moved out to LA and didn't do any of that. I just did whatever gigs. And I actually, you know, I did tour when I was living in LA, but the tours that I got were still out of Miami. So I was still getting called for like Latin pop tours. Even though I had left it, they were still calling me to do it. So it was like, okay, that's cool. I can live in LA and still be able to work. But yeah, really the only touring gigs for the most part I got when I was living in LA were still the Latin pop tours. So I couldn't get away.
So would you say that when you were in LA, you did more recording sessions?
I didn't do any recording sessions in LA.
Oh, where was the Santana thing?
That was all in Miami.
Oh, still in Miami. Okay.
The stuff I did in LA was just like the most random. Some of them were little gigs. Some of them were some of the tours that I was getting out of Miami. And just, you know, I had my eyes set on, oh, I want to audition for a bunch of tours and get on the Barry Squire list and all this stuff. And that never really panned out. I think I did a couple auditions or cattle calls, and I really didn't like that type of thing. But when I was, you know, I kind of put that stuff on the back burner, like trying to get on a huge, you know, pop arena tour. I put that on the back burner and just enjoyed my time in LA, playing little gigs. And that's kind of how I discovered, you know, West Coast blues, or like that really early vintage blues, because that's something that I never was, you know, there was never a scene in Miami for like old blues kind of vintagey stuff. That's one thing that I noticed that you don't really get anywhere else in the country, except for Southern California in particular, is this like love for, you know, vintage culture and rockabilly, and it's, you know, it's a scene thing. That's something that I discovered living in LA, and that's kind of something that I took and, you know, made that a part of my style as a guitar player now, because I'm like, oh, this is something I can really, you know, gel with. So, you know, I started a band called RJ and the Del Guapos when I lived in LA. So that was kind of like, man, I love, you know, early rock and roll, Chuck Berry, Little Richard, stuff like that. So that kind of helped mold my style. Because when you're a session musician or a touring guy, you basically have to copy whatever style is on the record. You don't really have necessarily your own voice, and that you're hired to be able to copy whatever's on the record or whatever. I didn't know who I was as a musician until I started living in LA, because I kind of matured and was like, you know, I was asking my question, so what kind of style do I play? What's my personal voice as a guitar player? So, you know, blues was something that I've always loved ever since I was a kid. So that was definitely the core of my kind of my style, my guitar playing style. And LA was probably a big influence on that, because, you know, I was playing with rock bands, I was playing metal stuff, I was playing all different styles, but I wanted to play and learn about blues music and different types of subgenres within blues, and really, like we said, really nerd out about it and kind of get, you know, the history and how it works and where everything came from.
Nice. And after LA, where did you go?
Well, we moved around, you know, parts of LA, and then 2013. Towards the end of 2013, I had just gotten off of a tour with my friend Judith Hill.
I love her voice.
She's so good.
Yeah, I just want to say that I'm really jealous of you for having played with her.
Man, that's another story, but that's like, it's funny how the universe works, how we met and how I continue to kind of appear in her life as a guitar player. Because long story short, we met on a gig, like it was a TV gig. She was performing on the TV show, and I was in the house band, backing band. That's how we met initially, and then she took all of the band members' numbers because she was gigging around town, and she started calling us. Eventually, she just kept on calling me and not the other band members, and hired other band members. So, like, I was gigging with her around town for a lot of the time I was living in LA. And then I did that tour with her in 2013, and I moved to Chicago, actually. So my wife and I just wanted to get out of LA. It was kind of too unaffordable for us for the way that we wanted to live. We wanted to live in a neighborhood that we couldn't afford and all this stuff. So we just like, let's go back to the Midwest, because we're both from Michigan and we have a lot of friends that live in Chicago. Chicago is a great city. So we moved there, But I had also gotten a gig out of Nashville with a touring pop country group. So I had taken the gig and basically commuted between Chicago and Nashville for about a year and a half. So I was living or paying rent in Chicago, but I was basically down here in Nashville more. So where was I going with that? Oh, yeah. So eventually we decided, let's just move to Nashville. That's where I'm working. I was touring every year. It was good gig or whatever. And then like 2 years ago, I was doing my normal Nashville touring gig, but then I got a call from Judith Hill to do some touring in Europe. I'm like, heck yeah, I want to go to Europe. It's been like, at that time, it was probably like 4 years since I had played with her and everything. So it was cool to get back into that jam hang and everything. So 2018, I'm kind of going all over the place. What was the original
question? That's fine.
But anyways, what I meant was like, yeah, it's funny because, you know, I'm still, you know, technically playing with Judith Hill now and then. That's crazy. After like over 10 years. It's been 10 years now, I think, I've known her.
Okay, so you've done reggae, R&B, the whole SoCal blues. And how did you get the country call?
So my friend Victor Broden, who is a bass player that I met in college in Miami, actually, he had contacted me towards the end of 2013. I was still in LA. He was actually looking for me to recommend a guitar player for the gig. And I had told him, look, I'm leaving LA and I'm interested in getting a gig because I don't have anything. My plan was just going to Chicago and maybe getting some regular job and just hanging out for a little bit. Okay. So I'm like, you know what? I'm moving to Chicago, but Nashville's not that far, so I'll do the gig. But I had to audition. I had to send in like a video audition and do that whole thing. But I got the gig. So basically January 2014, I flew to Nashville to rehearse and get ready for this tour that would be most of the year and after that. So yeah, that's how it happened.
Country saved you from the regular workforce.
It did. It's always a sign. It's funny, like, there's been multiple times in my life where I tried to leave music. I don't know why. Maybe because I just wasn't digging what I was doing at the time. Maybe it was like I was sick of playing in bars or sick of doing wedding band stuff. But there's two times prior to that time where I had kind of... the first time I applied to culinary school in New York, I'm not getting the gigs I want. Let me just quit music for a little bit. And I was really into cooking. I still am. But I had applied to the French Culinary Institute in New York, got accepted. I was looking for housing and everything. And then I believe that's when I started getting some other gigs in South Florida that were enough for me to just like do gigs for a living. So I'm like, okay, never mind. I won't go to cooking school. I'll just be a musician. So the second time I was doing these cover band gigs and, you know, making a decent living, but it was boring. I hated playing covers. I was tired of just, you know, 3-4 times a week, late nights and everything. So I decided to apply to Chinese medicine school. There was a there was a traditional Chinese medicine school in Fort Lauderdale, and I was really into health and acupuncture and like, you know, Chinese herbal stuff and everything. And it was something genuinely, even to this day, I'm genuinely interested in that type of stuff. So I was like, you know what, let me apply. So I got in, and I was going to send in my tuition and everything. And it would have been fine because I lived in Fort Lauderdale, so it was just like a matter of driving back and forth. It wasn't a big move or anything. And then that's when I got the Ricky Martin gig.
Okay.
So I'm like, okay, the universe tells me like, no, you are made to do music, so stop.
Yeah.
It pulls you back in. It's crazy.
That's awesome.
So if I have any advice, if you're struggling and you want to get a gig, leave. Like, try to leave music, and then maybe the universe will pull you back in.
Yeah. In my case, it was a pretty good wake-up call from my wife, because we had just moved to the U.S., and first couple of years just adjusting here, nothing was really happening for me.
When did you move here?
2004.
Okay.
Yeah, so nothing was really happening for me, and I was just, you know, pretty much just staying at home and all that. And then just one night we were talking, and I was saying something like, maybe I should get a job at Target or something. And she got pissed, dude. She got pissed. It's like, well, if you're gonna do that, let's just go back home to the Philippines, and that way you're doing what you're supposed to be doing, you know. And that just woke me up. It's like, oh, okay. So, you know, stop, put that out of your mind, and just, you know, focus on what you need to do.
Yeah.
You know, but
that's true. Yeah, she has a good point.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Where were we? Nashville.
Yeah.
At the time, did you have a sort of an idea of the current trend where you could pretty much live anywhere, but you could still get calls for work, to do work and stuff?
Well, as a touring musician, you mean, or as a...
As a musician in general.
That's just now hitting me.
Okay.
That I could... Like, I don't necessarily have to be here in Nashville, but that's because of the industry that we're in now, which is, you know, this whole YouTube online thing. Obviously, you know, you have to be in Nashville to do touring stuff, but now it's kind of, you know, I'm playing with the idea of, like, you know, I can live basically anywhere now. You know, people aren't relying on me to necessarily be somewhere in person, and which is scary, but it's also awesome. I mean, my wife and I have talked about, like, different places we would like to move to, and, you know, probably right now is not the greatest time, but in the future.
Yeah. Well, and if they need you in person, they'll just fly you out. Let me, like,
yeah,
have been done in the past, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, a lot of it has to do with, now that I have a foothold in the industry or whatever, or and people know who I am, it's more common that can happen. Because, like, so I was living here in Nashville, but Judith was living in LA still, mm-hmm. and she still, you know, flew me out to LA to do rehearsals, and then flew me to Europe to do the gigs. So that can happen now, but maybe like 5 years ago, 10 years ago, that would have never happened, you know? So I feel like I'm old enough, like I've matured to a point where, you know, my position in the industry is, you know, I have a little more clout and say, I guess.
That's good. Okay, and then transitioning to our industry now. What was the deciding factor for you to switch from a touring musician to like a full-time YouTuber?
It was kind of gradual. I was touring at the same time I was doing gear demo stuff. You know, the first gear demo stuff I did was with Eastwood Guitars. So they would send me guitars whenever I was not touring, and I would work on those things, and then I would let them know that, hey, I'm going to be out for the next month or two, so I can't do anything. So it was cool, it was easy. Eventually other companies started contacting me, like pedal companies and amp companies and everything. So it was cool, because I was still touring, but, you know, whenever I would be home, which wasn't that much, maybe like a week or 2 weeks here and there, I always had work that I could do, so it was, you know, extra income on top of the touring paycheck. And then, you know, I did the Nashville touring gig for like 5 years, and towards the end of the fifth year, I was just burnt out basically on traveling and touring.
Okay.
I love playing music, I love playing live, but it was the travel and the touring that was very hard on my health and rest and everything.
Okay. Hurry up and wait.
Yeah, it's just, you know, there was times where I can't remember, but I basically had to take I was on a plane like every morning for like a week. Like I had to wake up at 3 a.m. every day for a good week to fly to different parts of the country. And it was just like, I can't, you know, that's so tough. That's like so, and then like be expected to play a show that night and then to do the same thing over and over again. And that takes a toll after a while.
Yeah, because I remember watching your tour vlogs, like, and the first few tour vlogs, you're really nice, fresh, excited. And towards the end, I can see it.
Yeah, I like sleep too much. That's the thing. I like lying down and sleeping too much, and you can't do that when you have to walk through TSA and all that stuff. Basically, at the end of 2018, I decided to just make a clean break from touring and jump into the whole YouTube gear demo, whatever, lesson package thing full time. And it's been great. 2018, I basically did as much touring as I could. So not only did I have my Nashville touring gig, but the beginning of the year I subbed in for Stone Sour, and then I did 2 European runs with Judith that summer and then that fall. So I intentionally just got it all out of my system because I knew I was going to leave. And like my plan for the, you know, going YouTube full time was actually started a year prior to that. I would say 2017 is when I started getting the thoughts in my head, like maybe I can not tour anymore at some point and just do YouTube, but we'll see how it goes. And so I did 2017 and 2018, and by 2018 I was like, yep, I'm gonna do this. I think, you know, the channel was creating enough momentum where I was comfortable enough to make that switch. That's what it took. I think it'd be harder if it's someone just jumping in, like someone who's a musician and just being putting all their eggs in the basket of YouTube. It's scary. For me, yeah. I was scared. So I told myself, if I feel that my channel is doing well enough where I can trust that I can possibly make a living just doing that, then I'll make the complete switch.
Now, around that time, was your channel pulling in enough revenue to sort of like compensate for the touring, lack of touring? Was it getting there?
When I quit touring, you mean?
Yeah, yeah. Like while you were touring, maybe 2018.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Was your channel?
I saw the revenue from YouTube. I saw that as just a nice kind of cherry on top of my regular touring income. So it was definitely not something I could just live off of, just that. But, you know, a lot of people don't know, at least for me, a lot of the income I make isn't just from one source. You know, it's not just from YouTube ad revenue. I have my hands in multiple things, and that's the only way that I can make it work.
Yeah. Well, that's pretty much the way musicians do it nowadays. You can't just do one thing and have it pay for everything. It's you gotta spread out your fingers and put them in different pies.
Yeah, that's kind of what, you know, I thankfully learned that while I was touring. That was kind of on accident. You know, I would have been fine just being a touring musician and that was my only income. But, you know, because of what's happening now, my friends that did that, you know, are unfortunately not touring anymore. So they have to, you know, struggle to find something else. So I think I was lucky that I decided to get into YouTube and all this other, you know, the gear demo thing, just to put my hands in other revenue streams. Because, you know, now that we're not touring, I still have other things that I can do.
What are some of the other revenue streams without getting into details?
One of the things that a lot of people were telling me a couple years ago was lesson products. So, selling, you know, a lot of people do this, selling like a lesson package online for either a set amount or maybe a subscription thing to your website or whatever. So that's one thing that I think is something that people, musicians, should look into. And that's something I did last year with Udemy.
The slide guitar course, right?
Exactly. So that's been pretty good. I would like to do more lesson packages. It's just, it takes time and it's hard to organize. But I've gotten you know, messaged by other companies to do lesson package things for them. Ideally, I would like to do it just for myself, because then I'm making 100% of right. profit. But then you have to figure out, well, these companies have a lot of customers already, so it, you know, you can play both things if you want or whatever.
Yeah. And they have the machinery in place to you know, promote and produce all the stuff.
They know how to promote everything. It's built in, you know. So that's something I'm considering. But what else? You know, a lot of gear demo stuff is pretty much the bulk of the stuff that I do. So, you know, those three things, and then we get like a little bit of the Patreon, Teespring, mm-hmm. affiliate. I mean, there's tons of things that I never knew that you could make income from. It's stuff that I just kind of discovered and kind of fell into it. Like, I would have never thought of making T-shirts. I would have never thought that people would buy T-shirts with my logo or my name on it. But people do every month. It's crazy. That's something that I learned to do. Patreon, I never thought I would start a Patreon page. I'm like, I don't know. People, who would want to throw me money every month for special things or whatever? But people do. It's amazing. And I do too. Mm-hmm. You know, I subscribe to people's Patreons as well. So it's weird how the industries or new industries pop up, or, you know, other business ventures have popped up. Because, if you know, if you asked me 5-10 years ago if I would have been making T-shirts or selling a guitar slide lesson package, I would have been like, no. So it's changing. Technology changes, yeah. And business changes every day, so you got to keep up with it.
Well, I guess it's also maturity as well. I remember when I was younger, it would be like, oh, everything's about the music, man. I don't want to think about the business or money and all that. It's just, you know, I just want to play. But now it's like, oh, okay. You want my shirt? Here's my shirt.
And it's funny because, like, I mean, I don't have employees. I do everything pretty much myself. So it's a lot of work trying to keep up with these different things, like, you know, everything from, I mean, people don't realize that I do all my video editing, I do all of my promotion, I do all of my Patreon stuff, I do all of the Teespring. I design the Teespring. Well, I don't design, but I put the designs on Teespring and arrange it, everything. And that's just, you know, I don't have a team. Like, there's some, you know, big YouTubers that have a team to help them out, but I don't know about you, but me, it's just me. I'm constantly working. That's probably why I'm burnt out right now.
you're looking at my team.
yeah, me too.
That's pretty much it.
That's kind of the beauty of it, is because, not that I'm a control freak, but the fact that I'm just doing it all on my own is very satisfying.
It's the same here too. It's, you also learn as you go along. And it's the learning process that keeps me going too. It's like I'm designing this new shirt design, but then I'm learning to do it in Photoshop by myself.
Yeah.
And there's that whole process, but it's not a very efficient way to work. You know,
it's hard. I got lucky because I took like web design classes many years ago, but so I learned Photoshop back then, and so I know a little bit. Actually, I did some professional work as like a web designer and Photoshop stuff, so I have a little bit of skills in Photoshop to get by. Video editing is something that I had to learn. Camera stuff is something that I had to learn. Recording, you know, I knew basic recording stuff, but now I've kind of learned how to sort of mix things for my videos and everything. So it's a lot of things to learn along the way, but lucky for me, I enjoy learning and nerding out about camera gear or like software and all that stuff. So you kind of have to have that type of personality.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Top tips for aspiring YouTubers.
How many? I don't know.
Just three or so.
Be yourself, because people will watch anything. Like, literally, there's videos of just about the stupidest crap on YouTube with millions of views. And that just goes to show you there's people out there that will dig what you're doing. Usually, I guess. But, yeah, don't try to jump on bandwagons and try to do the same lessons or gear demo styles as some other people. Just kind of do what you do, do what you do through your personality and what gear you have available. Second one, let's see, there's a lot. I mean, a big tip that people talk about is consistency. Something that I learned maybe the first year that I was full-time YouTube. I mean, I knew about it. I just didn't know how to go about or to schedule my work so I could be consistent. I want to get to a point where I have videos a month in advance, but okay. It never gets to that point. I think there's the best that I've ever done. I think I had videos like 3 weeks in advance, and then like I'm like, oh, I can just sit back and rest and whatever, and then like once they were uploaded, I'm like, oh man, I don't have any more videos. So that's, it doesn't work for me, because when I know I don't have to do work, then I won't do any work. So I can't work ahead like that.
I think I've gotten to a point where I had like 4 or 5 videos scheduled, but then I take a look at the creator studio and I just feel that those videos get old, and I have this innate pressure to, I'll just make this public right now because I don't want it to get old. So that's something that I constantly fight with.
Yeah. My schedule, I always do 2 videos a week, sometimes more, but never less than that. So,
is that including the live stream or
that's separate apart from the live stream? Yeah. Okay. So I do 3 videos, I guess, with the live stream.
And is there a specific day that you release those, or?
It's usually like Monday and Thursday, but it's any spread along those lines. So it might be a Sunday and Wednesday. It might be a Tuesday and Friday, but I like to keep that space between my uploads. Yeah. But yeah, it's usually Monday, Thursday.
It's funny. We almost work the same way.
Yeah.
You know, mine is Tuesday and Friday. Unless I'm really excited, then I may release it like Monday, or I may release it like Thursday.
Yeah, I'm the same way. I'm the same way.
Yeah. And then do you shoot for a specific time when it goes live?
I don't. So I don't schedule my videos automatically anymore. It's really, I'll wake up and sometimes I'll publish it then, like when I'm still in bed, or I'll wait till I have breakfast and then do it from the table or whatever. So I don't have a specific like 8 a.m. every day, 8 a.m. every time or whatever. It's usually sometime before 10 a.m. my time. Unless a company specifically says do it at this time.
Okay. But those videos are already uploaded, but like unlisted or private,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Okay. So be yourself, consistency. Do you have another thing you want to add?
Yeah. It's gear related. You can get started with your smartphone, because the smartphones these days are really good cameras. The next step, like if you're using your iPhone or whatever to do videos, the next step would be to get better audio. So if there is a way you can separate the audio from the video, whether it's recording into your DAW or recording into like a Zoom recorder, and separating, like if you're doing guitar and talking about a lesson or whatever, separating your vocal mic from your guitar signal and mixing it in. So that's when you do have to learn a video editing software in order to do that. So that would be like my first initial steps to improve your quality. You know, start with the audio, and then as far as video quality, just improving your lighting would be the first thing. Before you go out and buy expensive cameras and lenses, just getting a simple softbox kit from Amazon does wonders for your quality of video.
Okay, I skipped this question earlier. For gear demos, okay, because do you keep the gear?
Yes. For the most part. I mean, like, it really depends on the company and it depends on what the gear is. A lot of the guitar demos I have to send back. That's just the normal thing, which is fine because I have plenty of guitars and I don't have room for to keep guitars. But like the pedal demos, you know, for the most part, they let us keep because the cost to ship back and forth and it doesn't really make sense. So they're okay with leaving the pedals with me. There's been some companies where they've sent me like the prototype or the only model that they had that I had to send back to the company or send to another YouTuber or whatever. So that happens and that's fine. I'm trying to think if there was ever a piece of gear that I had to send back that I really wanted to keep. It really depends on the company. But I've got a ton of pedals.
And is that on top of your fee for demoing it?
Yes, usually. I mean, all of my relationships with companies vary widely. You know, it could be a small, like my friend that has a pedal company. I might say, hey, just give me the pedal. I'll do the demo for free or whatever. Or it could be a bigger company and, you know, it's a fee for the actual video and then I get to keep the piece of gear or whatever. Or it's a mixture, you know, maybe the fee is lower and I get to keep the piece of gear or something like that.
Okay. So, yeah, negotiation. That's the key.
Yeah. I don't have I do kind of have an average price that I like to do, but it kind of goes, you know, above or under it, depending on the company.
Well, that's the thing, too, because for this to work, you need to know what your work is worth. That way it's not like, oh, well, just pay me whatever. Then, you know, or you say, oh, it's up to you. It makes it vague that way, I think.
I mean, I'm the type of person that's really, I'm modest, so I'm uncomfortable asking for, you know, my top line price all the time. And it's I'm getting more comfortable now because, you know, I've been doing it for so long. Now I have enough content up there. Now I have enough subscribers where I can be like, you know, this is what I'm worth. Because I have colleagues that are the same numbers and, you know, I know what you're paying them. So, you know, just make it equal. And most companies are super cool and they're totally understandable. Right. I mean, I have a lot of YouTuber friends that are like, you know, we're totally not charging enough, you know, what we're delivering them and how we're helping promote their product and everything.
And the amount of work that we put into this stuff too.
Oh yeah.
If we were to get paid hourly, it's nowhere near enough.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Even minimum wage.
I try not to spend a lot of time on video editing and stuff, but if I was getting paid more, I would probably, you know, do a lot of cooler stuff. You know, I'd have more time to do cooler stuff and edit all this stuff and make it really cinematic and everything, but I have to do, like, if I could do one video a week and have that fee be enough to pay my income for, you know, my paycheck for the week, that'd be awesome. Then I could spend a week on one video and make it like the best thing ever. But I can't. I got to do like two videos a day.
Wow, two videos a day.
Not so much anymore. There was a time, last year was really good, but there was a good stretch of like a couple weeks where I was just doing gear demo after gear demo every day, nonstop. Wow. It's up and down, you know.
So if that burns you out, I mean, imagine working like Henning. Like, he does like some insane amount of videos like every day, like 8 to 10 videos every day. It's like, how do you do that?
He has it kind of dialed in because of his setup and the way his videos are. He just kind of presses record and just goes, and then
whatever comes out, that's what you get.
So like, I mean, I might do a 10-minute video for a pedal. He'll do like an hour video for a pedal, which is great because people will watch that, and it puts, you know, eyes on this one particular product for a long time. So, and that's his style. If I did that, people would be like, that's not RJ's normal style, you know? He has it where he can do that, and that's kind of his signature, you know? That's what he does.
Yeah, that's his niche. You know, aside from YouTube, you have a pretty strong Instagram game as well. Do you need the other social media to...
I like working on both, because what I do is I kind of work on both at the same time. So like, if I release a pedal demo on my YouTube, I'll use Instagram to promote it as well and direct people to go to my YouTube channel to watch the video. So I feel for what we do, those two platforms work the best. I'm not so much on Facebook a lot. I will post like stuff on my official RJ Ronquillo Facebook page, but I don't really monitor it. I don't spend a lot of energy doing that. It's more just like, here it is. I have a Twitter account. I don't do anything on Twitter as far as promoting stuff. Just because I don't think a lot of people are watching my Twitter page anyways. So I think YouTube and Instagram for me are the biggest, you know, audience for me.
Okay. And what's a typical RJ Ronquillo day?
Nowadays?
Wait. Let me rephrase that. Let me say it again. What's a typical RJ Ronquillo day?
There you go. Okay. Thank you. a typical day. Wake up, take care of the dogs. I exercise now. I have a stretching routine, and then I exercise before breakfast, which is something that I would never do. I usually would have breakfast, you know, whatever. Then I have breakfast, and then I start work, which could involve starting to shoot a video, or planning out a video, as far as like, you know, if I have to write out a script or an outline for something I'm talking about. Sometimes I spend a whole day just making backing tracks for my videos. Okay. But a typical day is a lot of emailing and a lot of kind of, you know, checking the comments on my social media and replying, checking my Patreon, checking emails, doing that kind of usually the first thing. And then I don't get started with like video work sometimes till after lunch. It's like,
okay,
which is kind of the beauty of working for yourself, is you don't have to make a set schedule. Obviously it's probably a good practice to have it scheduled and everything, but I mean, I usually work till about 4 p.m. and then I take care of the dogs again and then have dinner. And sometimes I'll go back to work and work through the evening or whatever. But it really does vary, which is what I like, because I'm my own boss. I can make my own schedule. I don't have, you know, a manager or an artist that I'm working with that I have to be here for, or be a certain place at certain times. So it's very comfortable.
Nice.
And then I go to the Turo Turo for dinner.
You order Jollibee.
My Jollibee.
Is there a Filipino community in Nashville?
It's super small. Like, no, there's literally one Filipino market slash
Asian restaurant. Store. Oh, restaurant. Yeah. Okay.
I mean, there's Asian stores, but there's only one that's like Filipino owned, and they have like a Turo Turo built in. And
okay.
But that's not even in Nashville. That's like outside in Laverne, which is like 40 minutes from where I live.
So wow.
I'll go there if I really need, like, you know, something, kare kare or something, and I don't want to cook it. So I'll go there like a couple times a year. And there's one restaurant that does like a fusion kind of fancy Asian with some Filipino dishes. But other than that, that's it. That's the only culture.
Yeah, but there are other Pinoys in Nashville, right? Like Al John's from there.
Yes. Al John, and then actually I've met a lot, not a lot, but I've met, there's this one guy, I don't know if he contacted you, but he runs a company called Dream Audio in the Philippines.
Oh.
They're like they're a distributor for Universal Audio.
Okay.
But I guess he lives here, so we've been talking about doing some videos. But it was weird, like, he moved from the Philippines to Nashville. I'm like, who does that? And there's a couple, I think I've met a bass player who's Filipino.
Yeah, I think I saw him in one of your Instagrams. He's a touring bass player.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of his name. But, and, you know, a handful of other Filipinos that I've met. But it's not like there's, you know, church. If I go to church, okay. Sometimes I'll see like a Filipino family there. I'm like, okay, there they are. Okay. Because there's not a lot of Catholic churches in the South. It's mostly, you know, Baptist or Protestant.
Baptist,
or something.
Yeah.
So like the one Catholic church in town or in my area, that's where all the Filipinos go every Sunday.
Okay.
So that's where you find.
At what point in your... in your career, did you realize that you're a gearhead?
When I was a kid?
Yeah.
Probably. Yeah, probably as early when I was a kid, because I just would get the magazines and the catalogs and be like, I want this, I want this, I want that. So
no, I enjoy the posts you put on Instagram, like the old guitar for practicing musicians and all that.
Yeah.
And encircling the ads, you know? Because I saw those same ads growing up.
Mm-hmm.
In the Philippines, we didn't get the guitar magazines on time.
Right.
They were like 3 to 6 months later.
Sure.
Yeah, but then it's the, like I distinctly remember like going through the same ads, like, oh, I want that, I want that.
Yeah. It's funny. Know? It's kind of like even growing up, I would be into other things, and I would buy magazines, you know, like maybe like a karate magazine or something or whatever, and I would just flip through it, and I would never, you know, care about any of the stuff in it. But as soon as like guitar magazines come out and there's all this gear, I'm like, yeah, that looks cool, that looks awesome. It was like a shopping catalog or Sears catalog, or just like I want this for Christmas, you know. So early on it was just like really into gear, and that's kind of like part of being a guitar player. I don't even think drummers or bass players or keyboard players have that same, you know, passion for gear. I don't know. Maybe they do.
Oh, no, you'd be surprised.
Really?
One of the drummers in my local band here, he has 7 drum kits.
Okay.
Yes. You know, and it's... and
but does
and,
he go through drum magazines and be like, oh, I want these sticks or this snare drum or these heads or
he must go through something, because he'd go through a Yamaha phase, and everything, all his kits would be Yamahas, like different vintages.
Yeah.
And then he'd go through Gretsch phase or DW phase, and he'd go through like snobs too, like, ah, DW, ah, I don't like that. And then the next thing you know, he'd get like 3 DW kits.
That's crazy. That's drum sets are expensive though.
I don't know where he stashes them. Like 7 drum kits in your house, you know. Okay, I asked you this at the NAMM show, but I was playing back the video, and for some reason the mic was turned around or something, and it wasn't really clear. But what makes a piece of gear a keeper?
Oh yeah, it's if I'm able to get a good sound, like within 10 seconds. Okay. So if I don't have to twiddle the knobs to get to that sweet spot that I'm looking for, or find a sound that I really, really like, if it takes me longer to tweak it, then it's not for me. But if it's something that like I instantly plug in, turn on, maybe the knobs are at noon for everything and it sounds great, then that's usually a keeper. That's kind of how I test all my gear, guitar, even guitars, amps. So the less knobs, usually the better. I'm very turned off by gear that has a ton of knobs and stuff. You know, sliders, if it has two sliders, that's even better.
Yeah. Let's talk about this guy.
Mm.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a good one.
Yeah, so how did the signature pedal come about?
I think Zach from Mythos approached me about doing a signature pedal. We were talking about, like, if you were to have a signature pedal, what would be on it? Which is, you know, it's fun to talk about. And I don't even remember what my first idea was. I want to say it was something with a fuzz. But, I changed my mind a bunch of times. And the more and more I did gear demos, I noticed that one of the sounds that I really, really liked was overdrive with a little bit of slap echo. There was something about, and it wasn't something because, I was really into rockabilly at the time or whatever, but it was more like it just has this like presence. It kind of makes your notes stick out a little bit more without, you know, sounding like a chorus or something. So,
It's kind of like an effect they use for lead vocals. There's always like a little bit of slapback.
Yeah.
To get it to pop.
It's like the littlest amount of ambience you could put on something. Because it's not reverb. It's just like seriously one repeat. But it's just that a little bit of ambience that helps it stick out a little more. So my idea was definitely echo and overdrive. And then I was trying to think of names. And that's... I don't even know why I decided on Sus Mariosa, but I can't remember what I was watching. I mean, it might have been like Joe Coy doing something, and I was like, man, I got to name that Sus Mariosa. So I had named it, I thought of that name, and then because it's three words together, I'm like, well, I got to think of a third effect to put in there. So like, let's just go with a boost, because that's something else that I always pair with my overdrives is a boost before the overdrive to kind of push it a little bit more. So boost, overdrive into echo was the triad, the trio of you know, the three horsemen.
and how did you come who came up with the sliders?
Man, I'm trying to remember if it was me or Zach. I feel like it was Zach. He brought up the idea of sliders. Because I think I just wanted like one knob or something. Oh, you know what? The initial idea was to have the echo preset with no control. Like not even a mix. Like here's the sound. This is what you're going to get. So we talked about just having a knob or a slider. And then, I was like, okay, let's make the time and the repeats preset to my settings, and then they can at least control the level. And he's like, well, I think it would probably be a better business move to put a little control, whether it's internal or he thought of those little trim pots on the side, so you can at least adjust it. I think it was pretty much his idea with the whole design of the sliders and the graphic. And I sent him like the fonts that I wanted to use, because I'm like, I was thinking of like Jeepney type of font. So I looked for like a Jeepney font, and so that's where it comes from. The actual, so there's a sun, so that's the
Filipino sun.
Sun.
Yeah.
And then the actual font for the Susmar Josip is the font that I use for my video thumbnails, actually.
Mm-hmm.
So that's it.
Yeah, because the sliders are actually a really, really nice touch. It makes the pedal look really balanced. You know, it's not offset, like there's a weird knob here and then there's a low knob here, you know?
It's cool because, like, you know, the boost is obviously just a slider, but the echo, it has the side trim pots, so you do actually have control, but it doesn't look like you do.
Yeah. From a lot of comments on my video indicate that people are under the impression that this is a Filipino-made pedal. It's not.
It's not.
Yeah, it's handmade in Nashville, Tennessee, yes, by Mythos Pedals. See, I can't say it right anymore.
Mythos.
Mythos.
Mythos Pedals.
Mythos.
Okay, Mythos Pedals. For those of you not familiar with the brand, Mythos is a boutique brand. So for the money that you're spending on this pedal, it's a bargain, actually. It's so much. You know, you get the three pedals in one, three distinct high quality sounds in one, and it's usable in every situation. Like, I was amazed. I actually unboxed, as soon as it arrived, I took it out of the box and started twiddling with the knobs.
Yeah.
And I shot the video right there.
Nice.
It's like, oh, okay, so let me do this. And that's also an example of a video where I couldn't wait to make it public, but I had to wait a couple of several days because I had videos lined up too. It's like, I want to release this already, you know.
I know the feeling. Well, thank you for making that video. It was awesome.
it was fun, dude. I get a lot of comments like from my viewers in the Philippines, like, why are you speaking with an American accent? You're Filipino, or why are you speaking in English? You know, and everything.
So you that did, was Taglish.
I did the Taglish thing, and I did the exaggerated accent out of fun. I didn't lose a bet or anything.
I know. It was amazing. It was exactly what I was hoping for. I showed my dad and my sister. They loved it.
Awesome. So if you were going to go to a jam session, or if you were traveling light, would this handle all the things that you'll need?
It would if it was a situation where I was playing my own style, because that pedal is kind of like my sound in a box. Obviously, for, you know, if you're a session guy or whatever, you'd probably have to take a lot more stuff. But if I was getting called to sit in on a gig or do a blues gig or whatever, I would just take that pedal because that's kind of my signature tone to me. Basically, overdrive and slap, and then the boost is great for, you know, if I want a little bit of push for the solos and everything. So if anything, I would add maybe a fuzz before that, just for some fun, but that would be all I would need.
Awesome. Yeah, you know, I was just thinking about this the other day, because the way I have the echo set, I have a slightly longer repeat, and I didn't tweak the feedback at all, actually. I just made it longer. Another thing I could see a use for this pedal is this would be like an ultimate boost type of deal, where you have the clean boost, and then if you want to tighten things up, you have the overdrive boost.
Yeah.
Right. And then you can do the Van Halen thing, where it's the echo before the distorted amp.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So
I should try that.
I haven't tried that yet?
No, I haven't tried getting Van Halen tones off of that. That'd be cool. I'm going to try that. Put it in front of my...
Yeah, so that's something I'm gonna try out too.
Yeah.
You know, that way it's not just... You don't just think of it as a strictly blues pedal. It's utilitarian. It's a Swiss Army knife.
Yeah, because, you know, the echo side isn't just that rockabilly slap. It comes preset to that because that's what I like. But you can get, I forget what it was, like 420 milliseconds of delay, which is enough to do like kind of ambient-y type of stuff.
Yeah. And you can certainly do like the Dean Park stuff where he has a set time and it's on all the time regardless of what the tempo is, you know, just to get the space around the notes.
Yeah. Yeah, which is funny because that's how he used to how I used to have my sound as well. I used to always have a little bit of delay, maybe like 120 BPM delay, just for a little bit of ambience. Even on my rhythm sound, it was crazy. I relied on that stuff all the time.
Yeah. Okay, this will be a quick round. Top three guitars.
That I own?
Ever.
Ever?
That you've ever played.
That I've ever played. Ooh. Okay, that 59 Les Paul that I played at Carter the last week.
Okay, the recent one. Yeah.
My Novo series, my Novo Crockett, which is the Cirrus J, the pink and teal, Rontelio.
Rontelio, yeah.
Yeah. And then, oh God. What did I say? Oh, my Sen Fullerton Strat. It's my favorite Strat.
Okay. Top three pedals.
Sus Mariosip.
That's three right there.
Sus, the Mari, and the Josip. No, oh gosh, there's so many. Sus Mariosip. King Tone Germanium Fuzz.
Okay.
Right now, I go through phases. And then the Sabadeus Funky Vibe, Univibe clone that I have.
Top three amps.
That I own?
Ever.
Ever. A Matchless DC-30. A Fender Vibrolux Reverb. And, oh gosh, this is hard. That I ever played.
Or even heard.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know what? I'm going to go with my Amplified Nation Steel String Sultan, which I have coming. Because I demoed it, and I loved it so much that I ordered one.
That's the Dumble style, Dumble Steel Stringers type.
Yes, exactly. So it's like a totally clean platform amp.
Yeah, I love the Dumble tone. I have a Dumble ODS clone that my friend built me.
Oh yeah.
In the back. And then for the longest time that was my main amp. I tried to make it do everything.
Yeah.
even the things it's not supposed to do.
They're so interesting. They definitely have a different voice than most other amps I've played. Mm-hmm.
Okay, this is going to be tough. What's the gear or guitar that you've lusted after but still haven't tried or played?
Gear. Ooh. That I've lusted after.
Yeah. But never had the opportunity to play yet.
Oh, God. That's a hard one. That is a hard one. Because I've been at Carter so many times that I've gotten to play a bunch of cool stuff now.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. You know, it's funny. I haven't gotten a chance to play the new Steve Vai model, even though I've seen it so many times.
The Pia?
The Pia. I never got a chance to pull it off the rack and play it at NAMM. And I was telling my friend that works at Ibanez, like, well, he was asking me, like, which color would you play, or what do you like? And I'm like, I think I'd do the gold because it's so gaudy and it's so, like, not obnoxiously, but it's like so ornate when it, you know, it's gold and it's got the fancy pickups and inlays and everything. I'm like, you got to go all the way with gold. So I think a gold Pia would be the one that's just like out there that I haven't gotten to play.
How close are you to be able to play it?
I don't know. I haven't emailed Ibanez or anything, so okay. that's down the line.
Okay, cool. Okay, what else is there for RJ to conquer? Like, what's your future plans?
I always say this. It's you know, putting out my own record as a guitar player. As an artist, you know, and it's, you know, I was sort of working on it earlier this year and then all this stuff happened. So I kind of put it on the back burner, but that's something I would say for the past year and a half that I've been kind of talking about. It's just hard to juggle when I'm working on other stuff. It's something that I want to put 100% focus on, but I have to make the time to do that. So It's that's probably the top thing on my list to hopefully do this year.
Do you have a vision for it?
I sort of had a vision, but it keeps on changing. I've kind of written out a couple tunes or riffs or whatever, how you want to call it. So it's kind of a little, I mean, definitely bluesy, but there's, you know, I think about doing a little more rock fusion-y things, but that maybe I'll save that for another thing. But definitely along the lines of kind of virtuoso blues, instrumental too. Yeah. I don't want to sing anymore.
Well, you know what would help make that happen is if you hire yourself.
What?
Yeah, hire yourself to make your own record.
Oh yeah.
That way it's like, oh, this is a gig. It's not something that I just want to do in my off time.
That's true. That's true. I have to put it in my calendar and I'm scheduled to do this gig for myself.
Yeah, you're on the clock. Chop, chop.
Yeah.
Do you have any other... What's your message to our viewers right now?
Practice makes perfecto. No, I mean...
That's awesome.
I think on behalf of all the YouTubers, thank you for everyone that supports us and watches us and, you know, hangs out with us. Just... keep on playing guitar. Do it for fun and the love of it, and not because of competition or money or whatever.
Yeah.
Okay, everybody, that's it. That wraps up our awesome interview with RJ Ronquillo. Yes, so thank you so much for the time and the insight and everything. I love doing this for all the viewers because it allows them to take a peek into our minds a little bit, you know, for the process and demystifies a lot of the things that we do. So thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. And we got to get that jam sorted out.
Yes.
Eventually.
We'll start a new one.
Yeah. Okay, so that is it. Do all the good YouTube things. Subscribe to RJ. If you were on Patreon, subscribe to his... What's Patreon's term for it? Follow, subscribe...
Patronize? I don't know.
patronize RJ.
Sign up. I think just sign up for the Patreon.
Yeah, become a Patreon. Become a patron, I think. That's the... Become RJ's patron if you're able to. But, you know, just enjoy all the stuff that we put out, and we'll keep doing it for all you guys. That's it.
Bye. Okay.
Bye.